Welcome, everyone. This is January 17th, 2009, and this is a teleconference on Patrick Lecture number 132, Function of the Ego in Relationship to the Real Self. And if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to bring them up or suggest them at any time. I've been referencing these as questions, but I know that sometimes they aren't. Sometimes they're a request for the discussion to go in a different way or a contribution. So I certainly don't mean to diminish your participation by presuming that I'm the wonderful know-all and be-all of all things. So
Jan, I couldn't access that 132. It was one that I didn't have, but I did find in the Pathwork of Self-Transformation by Eva is that connection between ego and universal power. Is that pretty close?
Pretty close, Harry. I think that'll do.
Okay.
And you've reminded me of something. Thank you. Function of the Ego is one of the few tapes that are commercially available. The actual tape of Eva giving the lecture. So it can be purchased from the Pathwork Foundation. And they used to sell it in cassette tape, and now they're selling it as a download. If you have trouble accessing the link, let me know. But it's interesting when I present a lecture that you can actually get a tape of Eva actually presenting the lecture back 30, 40 years ago.
Harry, this is Lou. Did you try the pathwork.org website? I was able to download it for free from there.
Well, I'm having a hard time with, I'm using a different computer, the one that I have been using. I had to take off because I'm doing house renovations here, but I haven't made the other one work yet, and I can't even get my Adobe to come up.
Oh, okay.
Harry, I'll email you a copy.
Thank you.
No worries. So the lecture starts out with one of the first paragraphs in it saying that the goal of our work here, as far as man is concerned, can only be one thing, and that is in becoming the real self. And then the guide goes on to explain what the real self is, and explains that the real self is all that is good, all that is creation, all that is joy, all that is divine. And that the real self is creation itself and is nature. And I notice when I read the lectures that I hiccup on certain phrases. And those hiccups are useful because it tells you that you have a question or a glitch or there's an issue that you may have with the phrase or the idea underneath the phrase more accurately. And I had a glitch when I read this paragraph in the phrase, "For nature can be wholly trusted." And the reason I glitched is first the guide says that my job is to access my real self, not the real self, but my real self. And that my real self is nature. And then the guide says that nature can be fully trusted. If you take out the intermediate parts of the sentences, what the guide is saying is that I, or you, can be completely trusted. So just take that in for a moment as a possibility, that you in your true nature, in your innermost self, can be wholly and completely trusted. And that your task here on this planet is to find that place, to find that inner self. And then the guide moves on to talk about the function of the ego as a place that is supposed to bring us to the real self, the inner self. Now, I learned a little piece of reality one time that I am fascinated by, and I found it to be a good analogy for ego. And that is ego as bone. And the little piece of trivia that I uncovered one time was that there are only two land-based animals that have no bone, skeletal structure, external or internal, of any kind. One is a slug, and the other is a leech. That every other animal on the land, and by animal, I even looked that up, in a multicellular organism, every other animal on the planet has some form of structure to support it. And the other piece of trivia that went with that was that without bone structure, an animal can only grow so large. So interestingly, slugs and leeches obviously are quite small, and that even worms, because I challenged that, and I said, well, what about worms? And apparently worms have a hydrostatic membrane that they puff up to act as support for them as they move around, and they're calling that an exoskeleton. So even worms have some kind of structure to support their body mass. Now, why am I boring you with this science fact? Because the ego, to some extent, is the bones, is the skeletal structure, or can be seen as that, of who we are. And what bones do is they may allow an organism to become large and to move and to run, to fly and to glide, but they also break, they're subject to joint damage, and they bring on all the other problems that bone and ligament structures do. So the ego being seen the same way, what the guide is saying is that you need the ego, even though it naturally over or underdevelops periodically. Okay? So a smoothly functioning ego is like a smoothly functioning skeletal structure. It supports you. It allows you to do what you need to do. At one point, the guide describes the ego as arms that reach out to receive or to give. And the trick with the ego is that once it has done that, it needs to let go. So a smoothly functioning ego, a healthy ego, will assist you in doing something. It will assist you in becoming or being or giving or doing, and then relax and basically wait for its next job, its next assignment, its next chore or task. So then again, the guide says that the only problems we have here on the earth have to do with an underdeveloped or overdeveloped ego. So if you can imagine there's one cartoon that a certain teacher uses, and she uses a car, like a little Volkswagen. And for the underdeveloped ego, she shows this poor, sad thing with no tire pressure, and its fender falling off, and dents in its side, and it's just exhausted, one of those little cartoon exhausted cars with its tongue hanging out, as if a car had a tongue. And that is an underdeveloped ego, and it's not able to transport your real self to where you need to go. And in terms of an overdeveloped ego, that was represented by a car that's way too big for its wheels. So far too much body structure, far too much, carrying way, way more than it was designed to carry, puffed up and grandiose, so that it can barely move along and function. And that would represent an overdeveloped ego. So with either an underdeveloped or an overdeveloped ego, you're either going to not be able to do enough of your task, or you're going to wind up with the ego taking on more chores or getting in the way of what you need to do. At some point, the question would be, what does the ego do? What are its chores? I've always thought of the ego like a bureaucrat. I've always thought of it like a very good administrative secretary. So that if you need something done, the ego says, oh, I know where that is. So if you want to go out, your ego figures out where your purse is or your coat. It figures out what you need to have with you. It knows where the keys are, or it can find the keys. When it goes out to start the car, it understands the process and the procedure of the car. It understands the street, the maps, the directions. It understands where you're going and where you have to be and why you have to be there and how to get you there on time. And these are all procedural matters. It has nothing to do, perhaps, with what you're going to do once you get there. So in the lectures, what the guide lists as functions of the ego, and this comes from lecture 158, which is the ego's cooperation with or obstruction to the real self. The guide lists that the ego can memorize, it can learn, it can collect creative knowledge, it can repeat, it can copy, remember, sort out, select, make up the mind, move towards a different direction. These are all things that the ego can do. But what the ego cannot do, it can imitate, but it cannot actually do, is to feel or to produce deep feelings. The ego cannot deeply experience. These are what the real self actually does to some degree or another. The ego cannot give a deep flavor to living. The ego cannot deeply know or be creative. The ego cannot be spontaneous. It can't reconcile the apparent differences or opposites. Interestingly, the guide says the real self can always have answers. That doesn't mean it knows exactly what to do, but that the real self always has a sense of where we are and why we are there, whereas the ego may not, because the ego is reality-based. It's looking around the room saying, why am I here? Whereas the real self may actually have a sense, I'm here for a reason, my conscious mind may not know it, but I'm just going to hang out here and find out what's going on. And the real self also renders man more alive and more fulfilled. Now, the one thing that the ego can do that the real self cannot do is to die. So the real self, being nature, being creation itself, whether your body dies or not, your real self cannot die. But there is such a thing as an ego death, because the ego is reality-based, and it is deciding who it is based on what is around it. And when circumstances change dramatically, that's what we call an ego death. So, for instance, if you were in charge of something, if you were a supervisor or a manager, or if you owned a business, and then circumstances changed and you wound up being a clerk or working for somebody else, that's what we would describe as there would have to be an ego death there, because there would have been a perception of being in charge, of being in control, of knowing what you were doing and being successful. And under the new circumstances, you would have to consider that you may not have all the answers. You would perhaps need to see reality from a different perspective. And this is what the guide very often calls an ego death in the lectures. And in this dying process, in this need to change, where the ego needs to give up its perceptions and find a new set of perceptions. This is what the guide consistently calls the death of the ego. So to some extent, that is part of the function of the ego. Now, if you turn to psychology, there's a similarity there. It's not quite the same, but it's similar. And that is that in Freudian psychology, the ego is, the ego's functions are described as reality testing. In other words, the ego is supposed to have a sense of what is real. The ego has impulse control based on circumstance. The ego has judgment, object relation, thought processes, defensive functioning, and synthesis. And by synthesis, what they mean is that synthesis enables the individual to think, feel, and act in a coherent manner. So synthesis is the process of the ego to recognize changing circumstances and adapt. Again, this definition of ego in a Freudian sense is very similar to the pathwork definition of ego. The pathwork just goes one step further. The Freudian psychology does not ask the question, why is there an ego on a spiritual level? And the guide's answer, once again, is that the function of the ego, the purpose of the ego, is to allow the real self to be accessed. So there's a paradox with the ego. And that's where the guide describes that first you reach out, but I'm going to back up a second, sorry. The guide describes that as a child, the child is the real self. The child, when born, has no problem interacting with the world in a natural, creative manner. But of course, that changes over time as it is acclimated and culturalized and socialized. So that the ego is necessary to allow the child to learn how to manage the functions in life. So if you think in terms of computers, you can think of the ego as the input-output manager. It decides what you're allowed to say and not insult or upset someone, and it structures what you hear and where that belongs. So, In a joke sense, if somebody says, go jump in the lake, the ego says they don't mean that. They mean, mind your own business or get out of my way. They do not mean go find a lake and jump in it. That's part of what the ego does, is it interprets reality and decides what we're supposed to do next. And a child's process with this is lengthy, of course. So you first reach out with your ego faculties. And the paradox is that what the guide says is only when the ego is sufficiently developed can it be adequately dispensed with. So you're building your ego and you're learning to live in the real world and you're learning to manage with all the factors that come in and out and the people that come in and out of your lives and the circumstances that you're dealing with. And on a spiritual basis, at some point, you're invited to dispense with the ego. And the dilemma there is that the ego has a sense of self. It almost acts sometimes like a separate being. And once you've got, if you play with the idea of little figures in you, you've got my real self and my higher self and my lower self and my ego and my objective observer and my this and my that, it gets very crowded in there sometimes. But if you think of the ego as having a persona and deciding what reality is and deciding that it's very, very competent to decide what comes in and what goes out, that at some point the ego is going to become really upset at the idea that it's no longer needed. So the paradox is that you build this mechanism like you build a skeleton to the point, to a place where you no longer need it. And where it actually can get in the way. It can retard your process at some point. So the ego is necessary to change its own mind and intent. It's like the ego has to do surgery on itself. And it has to decide to some degree when to leave, when the job is done. And that takes a lot of maturity. So sometimes the lecture titles are really, really good in terms of being, when you read the whole title of the lecture, it kind of gives you the entire lecture. So if we repeat the name of the primary lecture that I'm using as a reference, the function of the ego in relationship to the real self. That's what this lecture refers to. Now, there's a lot of different lectures on ego, and when I put up the study materials on the website, I referenced about 6 or 7 of them. I worry sometimes because I think people are going to freak out when they see that much material. But I'm not trying to say that you need to read all that material. But sometimes we get different ahas from different lectures. So I collected all the lectures specifically on the ego, or primarily on the ego, because I wanted to go through them and kind of get a feel for the subject, an all-around feel for the subject. So the last piece, which when I work on the lectures, I learn something. It's why I love to teach, because in teaching the material, I have to go deeper in it, force myself to go deeper than I might if I was just reading it. And I very often get some insight. And this lecture in particular gave me one of the strongest insights I've gotten in many, many months. And it happened when I got to the section on self-punishment and the fact that the quote is, not only your body, but your life conditions are a result of what you are. Now, let me introduce that a second, because the lectures aren't easy, and sometimes you actually need to read 3 of them to really get some of these points. They're a little obtuse sometimes. Brilliant, but difficult to understand. And what the guide was introducing at this point is that as a human being with an ego, that from a spiritual perspective, once again, going beyond psychology and going beyond human social and cultural ideas, that the personality exists before the body exists. Now, I've taught this many, many times before, and the way I teach it is that I imagine that you've got, when you're in the reincarnation chamber and you're about to manifest into this life, and you have your life task and your life plan and all these ideas, that you go into a special room and there is a wardrobe room. And you get to choose your skeletal structure. You get to choose your skin color. You get to choose the shape of your nose. You get to choose your eyes. You get to choose your talents and skills and whether you're going to be clerically oriented or not, whether you're going to have big feet or small feet, whether you're going to have athletic abilities or simply be very, very passive and undeveloped on a muscular level. And I get this from the guide, but this is my imagining, that you go into this room and choose. And yet, in this lecture, I was startled by the particular phrasing that the personality exists before the body. And the reason this matters to me is that what I feel the guide is saying is that you have developed not only your body, but your life based on your personality, so that you would meet your real self. And that the imperfection of the personality, the difficulties that the ego encounters in life, are not an accident. They are the invitation itself. I hope this doesn't sound too odd. But in other words, the difficulties that you have in life represent the very part of you that needs to grow and develop. And that if your personality exists before your body, then your body reflects something that you need to learn, something that you need to die into, something that you need to really accept on a deep and profound level. And it goes on to talk about self-punishment is a substitute for giving up the guilt-producing attitude. So for those of us who are not 1,000% happy with their bodies, I translate this to mean that if you do not like your body, and if that's not your issue, your place in life, your skills and talents, your ability to manifest a relationship, your ability to manifest a profession, anything about your life that you don't like was developed by you so that you could learn something, and that your dislike of it, which is a form of self-punishment, so not liking yourself for who you are, is a way of demeaning or critiquing yourself, that self-punishment is a substitute for giving up the guilt-producing attitude. And what this meant to me was that my critiques of myself as a human being occupy my time where I could be spending my time dealing with what I have to learn. And the other place the guide says this, if I can find it, sometimes I write all these notes and I can't find them. Oh, here it is. If you say often enough how bad you are, if you suffer enough from your guilt, you feel that you are still a nice person in spite of maintaining what is in actuality of no conceivable advantage to you or to others. And the way I read that is that critique of yourself instead of simply working on the issues that are in front of you doesn't serve you, and it doesn't serve the rest of us. And what this phrase did was it pulled me up personally and made me realize that my critiques of myself are to some extent selfish. They are to some extent infantile. That from a larger spiritual level, I gave myself these attributes specifically so I could bring myself to a realization of my real self, and that's my job. I'm not talking about self-analysis, because the guide, the lectures invite a tremendous amount of self-analysis. And I'm not talking about the ego function of looking at reality and gauging what is appropriate and what is not. I'm talking about what the guide names as self-punishment. To the place where you punish yourself for being who you are, that this has no conceivable advantage to you or to others. So when you read the lectures, you may not get, that may not be something that you stop on. This is something that I stopped on, that I had never fully understood in the way I feel that I understand it in this lecture. And that I understand this as a function of the ego being too invested in trying to match a cultural reality that I don't match. None of us match. If the society is full of blondes, I'm a brunette, I don't match. If the society is full of tall people and I'm short, I don't match. It really doesn't matter what it is. But everybody that I have ever known feels that there's some place within society or their morals or their spiritual belief system where they don't come up, they don't make the grade, that they're not good enough. That may be true. And what the guide is saying here is that punishing yourself for that reality doesn't do you any good, and it doesn't do anyone else any good. But taking that effort and either recognizing the limitations and or seeing what you can do about them, that does have an advantage. So at another point in the lecture, it talks about recognizing the imperfection of being a human being on the planet. And that in the simple recognition, it says you all have to accept your own imperfections as well as this life's imperfections before you can experience that absolute perfection is your destiny that you must ultimately realize. So in this part, what the guide is talking about is a larger sense of ego than an individual identity. That there's a place where we have an ego as a species. We have a concept of what a human being should be. And that if we don't meet that concept, we can spend time degrading ourselves instead of recognizing, no, we don't meet that concept. I wonder what that's about. And that if we go back and say, and our real selves are divine, how do these two come together? What is the paradox here? What is the contradiction here? If we are creation and nature, what is this perception that we have that we are not enough? And that by coming to peace with this, we actually find our real self. So does anybody have any questions at this point about the ego concepts in the lectures?
Jan, I was reading in this chapter I told you about, and it had a statement here. I don't think you've used this term, but it talks about the realization of the separate ego existence is an illusion, constitutes an extremely important step in the evolution of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Separate ego, what does he mean by that? Separate ego existence. Like the ego is split or something, huh?
Well, I'm going to... Let me describe something that might help.
Okay.
I have referenced before the idea... There's a teaching that talks about three different spheres.
Uh-huh.
Okay? The individual self-sphere, the universal self-sphere...
Okay.
And the God sphere.
Uh-huh.
And this is from the 50-50 teaching. And what this refers to is there's a place where I see the world from my viewpoint and I do not truly understand your viewpoint. So when I only speak from me, I see me as separate from you.
Okay.
But when I speak from the universal self-sphere, I have a chance to see both you and me.
Uh-huh, I get that.
Right. So you have an ego, and I have an ego. And then we have an ego. And this is what I meant when I talked about the human beings as a species have an ego. Human beings as a species have a concept, even though it might be in little tiny cultural fragments. But the human species as a whole has some very similar ideas about what people should be like.
Uh-huh.
But when you break off into your own ego place, to some extent you are separating from the rest of us, and you will be limited on what you can learn. And I think that that might be what that lecture is talking about. Separate ego place rather than ego as a function that all of us can participate in.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Jan? Yes. This is Lou. I have one question, and it's it relates to lecture number 158,
okay,
which was referred to in your list.
Mm-hmm.
you started the discussion by talking about how the ego, it's kind of like almost like a computer. You know, it can memorize, it can learn, it can copy, and it can do all these things for us.
Mm-hmm.
But it cannot actually feel or deeply experience anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's the function of the real self.
Right.
And on lecture 158, he mentions that feelings are an expression of the creative process itself, because feelings and the creative process are instant movements, which the lecture calls soul movements.
Uh-huh.
And I could follow until then, but then in the lecture he proceeds to say that these soul movements, these inner movements, have their messages and signs that cannot be heeded too much if the individual is to effect self-realization and to establish contact with the real self. And that's where it confused me, because if these are inner movements and soul movements, we should, because heeding something means you pay attention to it. So it seems that almost the sentence got kind of like flipped around, that it should be in the affirmative, like they should be paid attention to.
Okay.
To affect self-realization. And the sentence in the lecture is that they cannot be heeded too much if we are to establish contact with the real self. And so that's the part that confused me a little bit.
So if you can imagine that not every feeling or impulse is mature.
Okay.
Okay?
Now I get you.
Mm-hmm. So you want to allow the flow of creativity and feeling without presuming that it's an end-all and be-all in itself. And there's a process of being complete where we have the creative impulse and we put it out and our ego interacts with it and real life with our interacts with it. And as it matures and formulates and comes back in, it really reactivates our real self or joins with our real self. So it is not that it is separate, but a feeling in and of itself may not be enough for us to understand. Life actually has a purpose. So if we feel a creative movement going out, it needs to go out, it needs to manifest, we need to see the pluses and minuses, we need to understand our distortions and flaws, which are part of our real self, and interact with that and perhaps mature and release some of our distortions, and then allow that feeling to come back in a cleaner state. Now, I know you said you got the answer to your question, but I couldn't help it. I wasn't.
As soon as you mentioned not every feeling is mature, I got it. It's because
okay.
In my mind I was thinking of soul movements, because, you know, kind of like a poetic term, you know, soul movement. I was only thinking about it as being, you know, good, mature feelings. I wasn't thinking of the immaturity of some of our feelings, which is very true. If you have mature and immature feelings, you can't see them too much, because they might lead you in the wrong path, too.
Right. And I want to differentiate between good and mature.
Mm-hmm.
The soul movement can be good. It can be essentially your real self expressing itself. Maturity is a different story.
That's right.
So it is learning to activate and keep the life flow moving forward so that you can weed out the immature or distorted parts of your real self. That's the process of living. But there's a distinction between the process of living and judging something as bad or wrong. By saying something is mature or immature, you're only commenting on its developmental phase. That's all. You're not saying it's wrong or bad. You are saying, I think there's more. And we're allowed to want more. So there's a place where the guide very often describes life on this planet as being in a laboratory where we are, and he uses the words over and over again, We are transforming and purifying. Now, I can get really gross sometimes, so you throw up, and you realize what you've done, and you address the issue so you don't throw up again. So there's a place of throwing up and purging out things from inside yourself so that you can look through it and examine it. It's not that they're bad, but they're certainly not finished or developed to the place where you don't need to work on them in this environment. Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes sense.
So in lecture 158, it goes into, like I say, the name of it again, if you read the names of the lectures, which, by the way, are different in the edited versions and the unedited versions, so there are sometimes three different titles for a lecture. You can get confused by this sometimes. So they might have named it something in the 1960s, and then they renamed it in the 1990s, and then they might have renamed it again because the guy did not put a billboard up saying, this is the title. The title was deduced from the material. And as we reemphasize things, we might change the whoever titles these things, sometimes change the flavor of the title. But in lecture 158, which you were referring to, the title is The Ego's Cooperation with or Obstruction to the Real Self. So it talks about how the ego can assist or obstruct the real self. And it goes on to talk about the fear of pleasure, the fear of letting go, because the ego can't fully participate in pleasure. If pleasure comes from the real self rather than from the ego, then for the organism to truly feel pleasure, the ego needs to let go. And the ego may feel like that is death. And there's a, we've grown up on this planet with survival instincts, where we have learned how to keep our body safe, we have learned how to keep our psyche safe, and we have learned how to keep our social status safe. We've learned how to not be made to look foolish. And to some extent, realizing that we are foolish can feel like a death of the image we've created, that we're not foolish. And this is what I mean by ego death, where the ego needs to unplug and change direction and come around and see things from a different perception. And it may be hard for the ego to do that. It is not hard for the real self to do that, because the real self is creation. The real self is nature itself. The real self simply says, wow, I found something more true than I knew about before. But the ego may find that it had developed coping mechanisms for one level of interaction with reality. And on this new, let's say it's a wiser, more spiritual, more enlightened level of functioning, the ego may not feel that it has the tools to interact. So the ego may feel incompetent, even as the organism is growing and maturing. And that this is a struggle within us. This is where the ego's function needs to keep changing and adjusting to keep up with us. So that was just a spin-off on your question. I do spin-off sometimes. So were there any other questions? I have some more materials. I was just checking in. So in terms of the ego function, and I'm going to go on and just mention some other lectures, because if you may have gotten all you needed about the overall function of the ego. And then as I went through and researched this and found these other lectures, which I thought were fun, lecture 161 talks about the unconscious negativity that endangers the surrender of the ego to the involuntary processes. So I'm going to repeat that. Unconscious negativity endangers the surrender of the ego to involuntary processes. And in that lecture, the guide talks about where the ego is so afraid of letting go that it will not let its guard down. That the ego feels change is on the way, and the ego does not know how to handle it. So the ego becomes hyperactive, hypervigilant. And one of the guide lists some symptoms of an overactive ego. And one is that it prevents sleep, because the ego does not want rest from tensions and chores. It wants to stay alert. It wants to stay on top of these tensions and chores, because if it doesn't, they could wash away or shift, and the ego wouldn't know where it was. That an overactive ego prevents mutual involvement and love. Now, that's interesting, because the ego might think that a relationship would be a wonderful thing, but true involvement and love involves total acceptance of and transcending goodwill toward another human being. To some extent, when you are in a relationship with someone, you need to let go of the tight grip you might have on former thought processes or ideals or concepts, and really come to an understanding and knowing of who that person is, and an appreciation of who they are, even if they got there from a direction that you didn't get there from. I hope that makes sense. So I'm going to repeat this. That an overactive ego can prevent mutual involvement and love, because it cannot accept and transcend into goodwill. And the last thing that the guide lists is that an overactive ego can actually prevent deep, profound meditation. Because deep, profound meditation is a place where you release and let go, and to see if you can allow the divine to enter. Now, except for helping you not fall asleep or sit up straight, what does the ego have to do in such a situation? It is, in effect, out of a job. In the moment where you are connected to the divine, the ego itself has nothing to do. Its job is done. You can see where if you have an ego that's overly invested and wants things to do, it could actually prevent you from reaching out to such a divine place, such as love, such as meditation, or even something as simple as a deep, restful night's sleep.
Jan, would an overactive ego be the same as an overdeveloped ego?
Yes. More than likely.
And if one realized that maybe that's what they had, what would be the...
I learned a lot from these lectures. I think I have sometimes a very overdeveloped ego. So yes.
Yes. You're not alone.
Oh, okay. I can identify.
So keep that sense of humor, okay? Guys, you have to have a sense of humor to do this work.
Yeah.
But to be able to laugh. Okay? You overshot the mark. Well, do it again. You know, redevelop it. Relook at it. Pick yourself up by the scruff of the neck and say, okay, we didn't do it that time, but we're going to do it again the next time. We'll get there. We'll practice.
Mm-hmm.
The joke is that we call it a spiritual practice because we need to practice. And in a place of real love for ourselves, if we didn't have to practice, if we could do it right the first time, we'd be done. And we really wouldn't be focusing on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
the idea that something around embracing our imperfections is comforting.
Mm-hmm.
That I guess if we can see that we are not perfect and don't have to keep striving. Of course we're always striving to be better, but to realize that where we are, it's okay in our imperfections.
Yeah,
is comforting.
And that acceptance can feel like a giving up. So again, as you grow up as a child, you learn to hang on. You learn to hold on to ways of doing things. You learn to hold on to memory. You learn to hold on to learning a sequence of events. And this is a really good illustration of what the guide is saying, is you grow up and you learn to hold on to everything so that one day you can throw it all away and let it go. And really understand that this, all this holding on and all this learning and all this stress and strain and work was so that you could develop an ego that could act as a container to let you release, so that you could, with a mature mind, truly appreciate your real self. So the difference between an infant and an adult is that the infant is not self-aware of its real self. And so what we're reaching for is what we had, but we have to go on a journey to regain that, but with the addition of consciousness and awareness. And basically, we need to forget what some parts of the journey. So yes, if you have an overdeveloped ego, you've done a great job. You've got an ego, and you're aware of it. There's a huge positive to that, because if you aren't aware of it, how are you going to relax it? How are you going to pare it down? It is awareness that allows us to really be responsible for our lives. A child cannot be responsible for its life because it is not aware. So from a spiritual perspective, we spend our whole lives becoming aware so that we can really appreciate who we have always been and hopefully offer that understanding to the other as well. So it's at the hour, and I need to change a tape. So if you'll excuse me one second, I'm going to turn off the recording and change tape.